Thank you, crazy old Ted. Ladies and gentlemen, unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, I know this much. You start your speech with an anecdote. Now, this is supposed to warm up the audience and put them in a receptive frame of mind. I will now tell you an anecdote to warm you up and put you in a receptive frame of mind. Now, it seems that a man and a dog walked up to the box office of a movie theater. The man bought two tickets and walked in with the dog. The ticket taker, who was dozing slightly, tore the tickets in half, handed the man the stubs. The man and the dog walked in, found two seats, and sat down. A few minutes later, the ticket taker came to his senses and said, "Did I just let a dog in here?" And went running down the aisle and saw the man and the dog both sitting and quietly looking at the movie. And he grabbed the man and said, "Hey, what's the idea of bringing a dog in here?" The man said, "Well, I thought he'd enjoy the picture." And the ticket taker said, "You thought he'd enjoy the picture?" The man said, "He was crazy about the book." Now you're all warmed up and in a receptive mood. Now, that is only the first function of the introductory anecdote, to warm you up and put you in a receptive frame of mind. The second function is to provide a springboard from which you plunge into the main topic of the speech. Now, watch how I do that. With even dogs reading books these days, it is no wonder that so many of you are planning to take up writing as a career. I am here today to persuade you not to. I'm going to try to talk you out of becoming writers. I might be accused of trying to nip competition in the bud. That is perfectly true. But I also believe you will be much healthier and happier if you follow some other profession. I'm going to talk a little bit about the magazine business, a little about the book business, and a little about the theater. First, magazines. When you send a story to a magazine, it goes first to a reader. If the reader likes it, he sends it to a junior editor. If the junior editor likes it, he sends it to a senior editor. The senior editor likes it, he buys it. Now, on the surface, this is a very just and equitable system. It prevents the senior editors from being flooded with manuscripts, and at the same time, it ensures that your manuscript will get read. But let's examine it a little more closely. Who are the readers? They are the newest people on the staff of a magazine, usually people just out of college. They are underpaid, overworked, inexperienced. And yet it is their job to winnow out talent, to go through that great deluge of manuscripts and find something that's good. Now, to be sure, those that come in are god-awful. There are many that are just on the borderline, with a little wise editing, with a little sage advice, could be made into a saleable thing, but these people are not qualified. Seems to me the system is precisely backwards. The senior editors should get the incoming manuscripts and let the readers and junior editors do the editing for publication. Any intelligent kid with a pencil can edit a story for publication. But that's the way it is. Now, let us say that your story gets past the junior editor, past the reader, past the junior editor, past the senior editor, and he buys it. He'll send you a check if it's a first-class slick magazine like The Post or Collier's or Cosmopolitan. The check will run anywhere between $500 and $1,000. This is going to seem to you a very large sum of money, and you're going to grab it. And I can't say that I blame you. But I should point out that many writers receive up to $5,000 and $7,500 for a story the same length and no better than the one that you have sold them. However, I don't know any new writer who has rejected his first check. Now, the senior editor, the editor has your manuscript in hand, and he can make changes. That is within his power. Now, editors can make changes in the length of your story, in the construction of your story, in dialogue, in characterization, even in meaning if they want to. And there is nothing you can do about it. Most editors can't resist making changes. The reason is simple. No editor ever started out to be an editor. They all wanted to be writers and discovered they couldn't. But the creative urge remains. And the only place they can exercise it is on your manuscript. And they do some bloody things with the stories you send in. And you don't know about it until it appears in the magazine. Then there's a matter of illustrations. In all the magazines, the story is normally illustrated with a picture in full color of a laughing-eyed boy and a tawny-haired girl in a hot embrace. Now, you better put that into your story, because if you don't, they're going to write it in. I know a writer. Well, why be coy? It's me. I once sold a story to a ladies' magazine. They had no business buying this story. This was a story about a gang of hoodlums, breakers and enterers. Terrible violence. One fella got lockjaw from going in a second-story window. And I don't know why this guy bought the story, but he did. And he called me a few weeks later and he said, look, this story of yours, it hasn't got any women in it. And I said, that's right, wondering if he'd read the thing. He said, well, now we are planning a two-page illustration in full color, and you can't have a two-page illustration in full color without a woman in it. So could you just write a woman in for a minute, you know, somewhere in the story? And I said, well, all right, I'll try. And I took it home, and there was no place for a woman in this story, just no place at all. But I dragged one in by the feet and loused up the story beyond all recognition, sent it back to the editor. He sent it to the illustrator, who made a two-page illustration in full color with a woman in it. And then a few weeks later, the editor called me again, looking very hangdog and sheepish. He said, hey, this story of yours is no good. I said, yeah, I know. So he said, well, look, let's just forget about the whole thing. Well, I took that to mean that I should keep the money, so I said, all right. And I added, it's too bad you had to go and pay for that illustration. He said, oh, that's all right. We'll use that on the new Faith Baldwin. And he did. To sum up the magazine situation, hundreds of thousands of manuscripts arrive every year at the magazines. They are culled by a group of incompetents. If your story is bought, you don't get enough money. And to top it off, the story is subject to the idiot whims of an editor. Now, what do you want to write for the magazines for? Now I'll tell you why you shouldn't write books either. You run into the same situation, readers, junior editors, and senior editors. But the technique is different. You see, a magazine editor will hack your story to pieces all by himself. But a book editor will make you a party to the carnage. And the way they do it is by using a bunch of words, a jargon that is peculiar to book editors. Nobody else knows these words. Here's what I mean. You send them a manuscript, and they'll send it back to you with little notes in the margin, and the notes say something like this. This passage is not germane, or this section needs reorienting to the whole. And you look at this for a while, for a long time. And finally you telephone the editor. And you say, what did you mean by reorienting that section, where you said to reorient that section? And he says, oh, that. trying to place who you are because he's quite forgotten the whole thing now. He says, oh, I want you to make it meaningful in terms of what happens later. And you say, but nothing happens later. That's the last chapter in the book. And he says, well, yeah, of course. I meant in terms of what happens earlier. And you say, you mean the part where the hero kills the grocer while he's robbing the grocery store? Yeah, says the editor, that's it. Well, what's wrong with that, you say? Somehow, says the editor, it seemed to me a false note in the dynamics of the book. The dynamics, you say? Yes, says the editor. Oh, you say. Well, you think it would help any if I had the grocer kill the hero? Yes, says the editor. Yes, he says, that is the kind of rechanneling that is indicated. Rechanneling, you say? Of the narrative stream, says the editor. Well, this goes on and until you say, now look, the grocer can't kill the hero. Don't you remember? He's paralyzed, and besides, his wife won't let him keep a gun in the store. She's a Quaker. And he says, well, now the wife seemed a little gratuitous to me. And you say, oh, no, she's had a very hard life. Anyhow, trying to rewrite your manuscript according to these double talk specifications, more often than not, you absolutely ruin it, if it was any good in the first place. The way you make money on books is through a system called royalties. The author gets 10% on the first 2,500 copies sold, retail price, 12.5% on the next 2,500 copies sold, 15% thereafter. That means that if you write a book and it sells for $2.50 and it sells 10,000 copies, which it won't, you will earn $3,280.75. In this connection, let me point out that magazines pay up to $5,000 and $7,500 for a short story. Let me also point out that the average first novel sells under 1,500 copies, returning the author a profit of $350, which isn't bad considering that you only work a year or two on a book. Now, you've got to be crazy to write a book, and you've got to be crazy to write for the magazine, but you really got to be crazy to write a play. I'll go into that as soon as I can find my notes here. Now, tens of thousands of stories get published in the magazines every year, and thousands of books get published every year. But how many plays open on Broadway in an average year? 85 in the last few years has been the average number. When you submit a story to a magazine, when you submit a book to a publisher, it gets read. However imperfect the reader system is, it gets read. But when you submit an unsolicited play script to a Broadway producer, you haven't got a prayer of getting that thing read. Ordinarily, they don't open the envelope. In defense of producers, I must say that they are the most harassed people on God's earth. Everybody is always after them. Writers, composers, choreographers, lyricists, any number of people are on their necks, and so they have to surround themselves with stone-hearted secretaries and thick-skinned stooges who keep everybody away from them. That doesn't do you any good. You're like the orphan at the bakery window. You can't get in. There are two ways to get a script into the hands of a producer, two chief ways. First is to submit it through a play agent. Now, the agents are more tolerant toward new writers than the producers. Audrey Wood stuck by Tennessee Williams for many years when nobody would have anything to do with him, and you know what happened to him. The second way is to get your play produced at a little theater off-Broadway, maybe down in the Village or maybe out here in Champaign, on the chance that somebody is going to see it. It happens. Many of our biggest hits have arisen in just that manner. Now let us say, for the sake of this argument, that you have managed to get your play to a producer, and he's bought it. He hasn't actually bought it, he's taken an option on it. The option system works this way. He holds the play and pays you $150 a month for the first 6 months that he holds it. $100 a month for the first 6 months, $150 for the next 6 months. If after a year he has not produced the play, then you keep the advance that you've gotten and you get the play back. If the play is produced, these advances are charged against your royalties. These magnificent sums, $100 and $150 a month, are only recent benefits hard won by the Dramatists Guild. But let's say that you get your option and the producer now has to raise some money to put on this play. Now a simple one-set comedy with six characters is going to cost him about $50,000. If it's a musical comedy, it'll cost him anywhere from $150,000 to $350,000. That's the way costs are these days. Chances are he isn't going to be able to raise the money, and so he drops your option. But let's say he's leading a charmed life and he does raise the money. Now he's got a theater to find. At last count, there were 34 theaters in New York booking legitimate attractions. Every year, radio or television gobbles up one or two of these theaters. And about one-third of these theaters are tenanted by long-run hits that show no signs of leaving in the foreseeable future. So he's got roughly 20 or 22 theaters to choose from.